Hey, everybody, and welcome back to Gear 30 on the Blister Podcast Network. In case you hadn't guessed by now, this is not Jonathan Ellsworth and it's not Luke Coppa. Today, you're here with Tara Williard, and I'm coming to you from Elevation Hotel, where we have our Blister headquarters, which is located in Mount Crested Butte, Colorado. You can check out the wide variety of things we are doing and reviewing over at blisterreview.com. Well, for today's conversation, I got to talk to one of my favorite folks in the ski shop world, and that is Eric Helmbrecht, who is the co-owner of our Blister recommended shop, Powder Hound, located up in Girdwood, Alaska. Today, Eric and I recap what turned out to be an amazing El Nino in Alaska, starting with a huge, unprecedented storm in November, and it just kept up from there. We also talk through some of Eric's favorite gear this season, as well as some of the gear that I brought up to Alaska for a trip a couple of weeks ago. We touch on topics like Alyeska Resort now being on the Icon Pass. We get some local insider information on planning your trip up to ski in Girdwood, what ski racing looks like in Alaska, and a whole bunch more. Then we pivot to what might be an often overlooked topic when it comes to ski gear, and that is bindings. So we dive in on alpine and alpine touring bindings, and we get Eric's perspective on both binding reliability and longevity, and he comes at it from a ski shop and technician perspective, doing this year in and year out. So it's very interesting to hear what he has to say. We also discuss Eric's binding preferences, some of the trends that he's noticing, and a whole bunch more. Eric's expertise definitely shines through on this one, and it's a good reminder that before you make that next purchase, be sure to check out our list of Blister recommended shops, which are located around the globe, and talk to someone like Eric, someone who will give you the inside scoop, make sure your gear is working as intended, and whose goal is to make sure you have an awesome time out on the hill. Before we get going, this episode of Gear 30 is brought to you by our Blister Plus membership. What's better than getting a bunch of discounts on great gear, having one-on-one conversations with Blister reviewers to find the perfect gear for you, reading exclusive content, discounted access to our annual Blister Summit, and more? It's having all of that and knowing that every time you adventure outside, you are covered with outdoor injury-related insurance that works no matter where you are in the world. We built our Blister Plus injury insurance so that no one is put out financially simply because of an injury doing the outdoor sports that we love. As we head towards bike season and I find myself moving quickly on my bike around rocks and all these other obstacles, I know I have a lot more peace of mind being covered by Blister Plus insurance. So, don't wait until it's too late. Be sure to sign up today via the link in our show notes. And with that, let's get right into my conversation with Eric from Powder Hound up in Girdwood, Alaska. All right. Well, I am back on Gear 30 with Eric Helmbrecht, who is one of the owners of our Blister recommended shop, Powder Hound, up in Girdwood, Alaska. And Eric's been on Gear 30 a couple of times before, but I know it's been a little while. So Eric, welcome back. It's great to have you.
Thanks, Kara. Really happy to be back on here, and especially after a good season we've had here, and now it's bright and sunny day up in Alaska.
Awesome. Well, it's cool to hear you guys are finally moving into some springtime conditions. It seems like it's been quite the winter up there. So yeah, maybe just give us a play-by-play. I know it started on a pretty epic note.
Yeah, we were pretty curious on how this El Nino year would go. We tend to be a little bit wet compared to other spots on years like this, but it started with a huge storm in November, took the power out of, you know, from the entire town. Everyone was ripping around on their snowmobiles, as you guys call them. And yeah, so we dug out for a couple of days, got the shop back opened up, and it was full speed ahead starting in late November. Then it just kept coming. We didn't get our normal rain events that we do that would, you know, kind of bring some of the snowpack down. Right now, I've still got in the backyard, the snow is at the top of the railing of the deck. So we got a while before the snow is going to disappear.
That's awesome. Yeah, I got to see it for myself. And I guess, I mean, we're kind of on the opposite end here. Spring came super fast. Currently in Gunnison, everything is completely melted out. But just a few weeks ago, I was up in Alaska and there was so much snow everywhere and it was super cool to see. So yeah, I'm glad you guys not only just started on a high note with like a huge, whatever it was, like 6-foot storm, but that it continued on throughout the winter. That's really all you could ask for.
Yeah, we're definitely fortunate.
Awesome. Well, I want to hear what Powder Hound's been up to, but maybe before we get into that, let's just talk about some of your gear this season. As far as what you've been testing, what gear you've liked the most, and maybe what you've been spending the most time on this season?
I would say it's pretty split between two skis. You know, I got a pair of the Wrestler 10s, the new Wrestlers, and, you know, tested them out last year, loved them, and figured I should probably get a pair for my quiver. So I got a Wrestler 10 and put a Strive, a Salomon Strive binding on that one. And then for the more firm days, I was able to test out in mid-December one of the 2025 Enforcer 89s and fell in love with that pretty quick. So those are the two sticks that I've been spending most of the time on. Definitely we've had minimal firm days, but those real firm days, the Stokely Montero AR has been kind of a fun go-to.
Nice. Yeah, those are all skis that, well, I guess more so than the Enforcer 89, we've been spending time on the men's 99 and the 102. Plenty of time on the Wrestler 10, but then also the Stokely Montero AR. I know that's a ski that a lot of our male reviewers have been spending time on. But, you know, those sound to me like Crested Butte skis, Eric. So I don't know what's been happening on the wider side of things this year for the softer
days.
Yeah,
it's funny. I don't know. I'm just getting old, I guess. But I've been able to, the Wrestler 10 is a 104 in my length, and I have not had an issue with them. I do have, for a wider stick, I've got the old Enforcer, well, I call it old now, but the Enforcer Pro, the 115, and that's always a fun one. And then the Unleashed 108 is also a wider ski that I've been spending time on. But yeah, most days that maybe it's because it has been colder and we haven't had a ton of the real wet stuff like we usually do, but the Wrestler 10's been plenty for me.
Cool. That's awesome. Nice. Well, you know, I think we've talked about it. And just a couple of weeks ago, I was up there in your neck of the woods. My partner, Zach, has been working for Chugach Powder Guides the last couple of months, and I got to go visit him, which was awesome. And, you know, we kind of had a tricky week as far as weather. We actually hit one of the stormier weeks of the season as far as like no fly days. But we did get one amazing day on the heli, so I was very grateful for that. Got to take my dad out for his 60th birthday, which was like his lifelong dream. So that really came awesome. Together. And then aside from that, got to ski like quite the range of conditions at Alyeska and just really explore that mountain, which, you know, we never had like full openings wall to wall or anything, but got everything from like really slushy spring conditions all the way to a 2-foot powder day. So it was cool to see the mountain in a range of conditions.
That's awesome. Did you get some North Face time?
Yeah, got pretty much like perfect rope drop on North Face during the 2-foot storm. So that worked out great. Nice. I was up there with Brooke Edwards and she was guiding us around and it was just like immaculate timing, like patrols like dropping the rope and we're popping in. And it was so fun just to, yeah, get some untouched, like really good snow quality on North Face right as they opened it. So I was feeling pretty lucky as far as the timing on that one.
That's awesome. And the best guide to have for the mountain too.
Oh yeah. It's awesome. We love following Brooke around any chance we get. So that was great.
Perfect.
Yeah. And it was a good excuse for me to bring up a couple of our wider skis, especially on the women's side. And, you know, like I said, we didn't have like super deep pow every day or a lot of days on the heli, but it was interesting for me to compare kind of two very different powder skis, one of which was the K2 Mindbender 116. And then the other being next year's Armada ARW 112. So the Mindbender kind of being on the more like directional side, little less playful, but still pretty, you know, light and maneuverable. And then the ARW being like a super, like has a more progressive mount point, a lot more rocker in the tail, just a lot more playful. And I found that I really liked a more playful ski for some of those conditions. Even like on the day on the heli, there's a couple times where we were skiing more of a crust. And it's just nice to have a little bit more, especially like, I think in the tail, like not having to drive the ski as much to get it to release. And I think what I'm more used to here in Crested Butte is just like, you know, pretty firm conditions, like really always working to be in the front of my boots, drive the ski. But when I was up there, I was like, it's kind of nice to have a little bit more forgiving, more playful option. And so, you know, the ARW is not a ski that I would like typically take out, especially around Crested Butte, but it was really fun to have those two options to test side by side up there, especially in some soft snow.
Yeah, that's That's cool to hear your opinion on the ARW. We've been doing well with some of the skinnier widths of that, but was thinking about the 112 for the wall next year. So good to hear your feedback on that.
Yeah, it was cool. And especially the first couple of days at Alyeska, it was right after that. You guys had kind of a significant warming period. And so we were skiing like some deep slush, and we get some, you know, corn skiing and some slushy days here in Colorado. But this was like the deepest, heaviest, wettest slush I've ever skied. And it was just really nice to have a ski that like offered some, you know, suspension and like felt pretty like smooth and stable at speeds through some of that condition. But then also something that like was able to be playful and kind of push around a lot of that slush without a ton of work. So that was cool. Just also having the experience of skiing like the slushiest slush I've ever skied.
Yeah. Good to have a nice smeary ski for some of that.
Yeah. It was cool.
Nice.
Sweet. Well, what else? I mean, as far as other stuff you've been spending time on, do you have any input as far as like boots or accessories or anything else that's just kind of grabbed your interest this season?
You know, I was trying hard. I waited too long this season to get on a BOA boot. I'm ready for trying one of those for next year. This year I'm still on the Hawks XTD 130. After the second kid, I really figured out that touring is not as frequent as it used to be. So having a boot that I can kind of do everything with, I put an Intuition liner for the resort and then use the stock liner for touring. And so it's been working great, but it's time for kind of getting on something a little bit beefier. I think, jump back on Town League this year and, using that lighter boot was definitely, you know, no blame to that. It was a super fun race season, but, I think next year ready for a little bit beefier boot, maybe something with a BOA to test it out. We've had some really good luck with those BOA boots. The fit's been incredible out of the box, and haven't seen a single one come back broken.
All right. There you guys have it. Yeah. We're not a year in, but a season in, and, you know, on the boot fitting end of things, Eric has testifying that he has not seen a broken BOA come back. So I think that's significant. And yeah, I mean, from what we've experienced, especially on the fit side, because that's something I'm always thinking about when I'm in a boot, just having a more evenly tensioned lower boot, I think there's significant benefits to that. I've noticed it myself just with like better circulation through the lower foot. So I think that's a good point. And yeah, I'll be curious to hear where you end up next season as far as a boot upgrade. There's definitely some good options out there. And, you know, knowing that like the Hawks Ultra XD has worked for you, I'm like, well, maybe you should just get the BOA version of that. And then also test out, I think the Narbar component is interesting as well.
But, yeah, totally.
I'll have to follow back with you next season to see where you end up as far as boots go.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm excited to try something new next year, but it's going to be hard to go away from the Hawks because it is such a good boot.
Yeah. Well-rounded. But
we'll see. There's going to be a lot of BOAs on the wall next year.
Cool. Well, let's talk about what has been going on at Powder Hound. You know, you guys always have some fun things in the works, and I know you've made some upgrades to the shop, and I just want to get a read on how things have been at the shop this season.
Shop's been smooth. It's been a really fun season. We had some good return employees that have just kind of gotten better and better over the years. And one new thing that we put a big investment in was a new automated tuning machine, which certainly does not take the tech out of it. But it just makes a really, really high-end tune come out of our shop. So we've always taken pride in our back shop, and now we take even more pride because we ended up getting the Reichmann Slope Master, and it fit our space nicely. It does skis, snowboards, Nordic skis, and we've been doing all of the sorts through it. I'm really excited about how it's going to finish up with our rental fleet and some other rental fleets around the area that we're going to bring through it. But that's been a really fun thing this season. It was, 6 months in the making, had to do some construction in the back shop to support it. And then, when we got it delivered, took about a week to actually get things set up. So it was running smooth. And ever since then, it's been fun. We brought in a new tech. So we've got, Ross, we call him DJ Brossworth is his stage name. He's also a DJ. So he's got a good vibe in the back shop, but he's been running it. And then we got a guy named Bernsky, which a lot of locals know here. He's, He's a longtime Alaskan and spent a lot of time tuning on the World Cup circuit. So it's been fun having that mixture of young and kind of older generation of tuning mixed in a back shop. So that's kind of like the biggest new thing that's been at the shop this year, but other than just a bunch of good new gear.
Cool. And then I guess maybe for someone who doesn't know a lot about tuning or who doesn't understand like what the significance of a really fancy tuning machine like this is, maybe just talk about like what it's delivering as far as like consistency and like what you're able to do on a machine like this versus just, you know, like some kid like sharpening edges in the back or something.
Yeah, exactly. So before we've always had a Wintersteiger base grinder, which is awesome. It put a good tune on skis. What the difference is of the more automated tuning is you can pick your patterns. You can pick a lot more patterns, I should say. So every ski in our demo fleet has this, even our rental skis and rental snowboards have this beautiful pattern on the base. And so not only is it pretty to look at, but it does perform better on snow. You can blank the sides so the ski releases easier. You can change the depth of the pattern and the width for, you know, wetter or colder snow. It puts a ceramic edge, material to polish the edges. So you're not taking as much material off the ski every time. And it just, I mean, we can tune the edges into every 0.2 degrees, you can adjust it. So if you're really trying to fine tune, let's say a race ski, which we do a lot of, you can really find what's best for that athlete. Otherwise, you know, you can just get, you know, throw a snowboard through it and have the coolest looking snowboard tune and best riding snowboard possible. So, it's been fun playing around with it. It's definitely a fancy toy and it's always fun to have toys in a toy shop.
Yeah, that's super cool. And then when I was up there, I mean, I knew that you guys had some ski racing and that was like, you know, still a fixture of your ski community. But I think a lot of people have this misconception that like Alaska is all about big mountain skiing or powder skiing. And so maybe just talk a bit more about like the ski racing community there and then some of the events and stuff that you guys have going on. I know right before I was there, there was like a full course set up at Alyeska Resort. So it might be interesting for people just to get a sense that like Alaska's all, you know, for all types of skiing.
Yeah, certainly. So some of the, you know, some really good athletes come out of Alaska, whether it's big mountain or racing. And a lot of it is, you know, these athletes start as racers and that's where they get the fundamentals down and the strength. And then they might move into the more free ride or big mountain type skiing. We're fortunate to have one of the biggest ski clubs in the US right across the Magic Carpet from our store. So we work really closely with them and we see them often. It's fun to kind of, I don't know, we've had numerous people just in the past couple of weeks, you know, kicking around in the shop. And I talked to him and like just yesterday, a customer was boasting about how the tuning of the new machine has changed his daughter's skiing and the strength the ski has shown too, where it's not needing to be tuned as much. So it's getting everything just kind of tuned in. And then we've been, you know, selling these kind of tune memberships where it's a fixed rate at the beginning of the season and they can bring a ski in 5 times a week if they want. We're not always going to throw it over the stone because that takes away material, but we're going to fine tune the edges and make sure everything's running smooth. And we've had some really good feedback from that. But yeah, the ski club's incredible here. They've got all branches. So they've got everything from, you know, Mighty Mites all the way to a free ride team, which I think the free ride has grown to almost 120 athletes now, which just a couple of years ago, it was at 30. So that's definitely a big growing portion of it, but the racing is still huge. So it's really fun to watch these kids grow up and go and, you know, maybe be in the Junior Olympics or, you know, Worlds for a free ride and all this stuff. And you remember them as little kids coming in and buying their first little free ride ski. It's pretty fun to help these families and watch them grow and follow the kids through, you know, their stats on, you know, how they're, if they're hitting the podium, if they're close, where they're at and root them on from the shop. So we love being, you know, close to that ski club and the ski club. I don't know if there could be a better group of people on the mountain.
Yeah, that's awesome. And yeah, I think it's cool. I mean, you guys really are like at the base of the mountain, seeing it all and kind of being like a fixture in this whole community from the free ride side to the racing side. So I think that's really cool to hear about. What else has been going on at Powder Hound this winter? And maybe even more broadly, like what changes have you seen also going on at the resort?
Well, it has been unique or just different seeing what the Icon Pass has brought to Girdwood. You know, Alyeska was purchased a couple years ago from a Canadian hotel management type company, and overall they're making good strides. Like anybody new to a business, they have to learn some things the hard way, and I think they're doing a good job kind of putting one foot in front of the other now. The Icon Pass was, you know, as every local ski community might be weary of, a bunch of, you know, seeing a million new skiers a year on the resort. We don't have a huge resort. The terrain is high quality, but it's not huge. So there were worries about that. I personally, you know, we saw, you know, you notice certain days maybe of like during spring break. I remember California or some place in California had spring break and your first week of April or something. And you're like, why is it so busy? But really so busy to us is like a 5-minute lift line. So it wasn't a huge impact and it was sporadic throughout the season. The day to day, you hardly noticed anything. In the shop, we noticed more rentals. That's really the one thing we noticed. A lot of foot traffic buying, you know, more t-shirts and souvenir type stuff to bring back from a ski resort. But, you know, in general, it was a really nice way to bring some new folks to town and keep the businesses in town running smoothly.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear about. And I know we've all like seen different sides of this. Like I was living in Taos the first couple of years. It was on the Icon Pass and I definitely saw a bit of a change as far as like influx of people. And then, you know, for people whose livelihoods rely on tourism, it's not something I could easily complain about because I was working as a boot fitter at a local shop at the time. And so, you know, there's so many sides to that. And of course, it's easy to like be a little bit jaded when you're standing in the lift line. But it's also interesting because, you know, Girdwood is a little bit off the beaten path. Alyeska is like one of the, you know, kind of the ski resort to go to in Alaska. So sort of treating it as like a destination long term, do you think that's a good thing, a bad thing? Do you have opinions on that?
You know, I was at a gear buying show in Park City a couple years ago. And I remember seeing a sign that it was established in 1954. I forget when it was exactly, but I remember looking at it and seeing what's happened to Park City and Deer Valley and that whole area. And knowing that Alyeska was started a few years beforehand and what Girdwood still looks like, it was really, really kind of set in stone. I was like, hey, this place is not turning into that anytime soon. You know, those places are a lot closer to a lot bigger cities. We are far removed, like you said. It's kind of a unique situation. The weather's harsh up here sometimes. It's dark a lot of the year. So we are in a special little bubble where we might see the benefits. And if anything, it's going to be a slow growth. It's not going to be a big boom. So yeah, that's kind of a nice thing to think about when you worry about roads getting busy full of cars and, you know, this place turning into Aspen overnight is not going to happen. So that's why we all live here.
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, there is so many unique situations like resort to resort as far as like, you know, geographical aspects that limit certain parts of growth. Like I know that's how it was for Taos and then like housing. There's just so many different variables that can affect like what the actual long-term outcome is as far as like, does this become another Park City? Probably not. But then also like, how is the community adapting and evolving to it in the meantime as more people do start to come? But as you said, like you saw, you know, more people renting gear this year, and that's like pretty cool. It's like someone's experience is coming and walking into Powder Hound, having a great experience, and then skiing Alyeska for the first time.
Yeah, and maybe they'll come back, maybe they won't. Maybe they'll tell their friends it was a great spot, or maybe not. But I do expect to see a slow growth of that. The other thing it was such a hard year to judge that because we had so much good snow. So on years like that, and the rest of the West was struggling, or the rest of the US was struggling, they might have come anyways, you know? So you can't really balance it on, was it the Icon or was it just that we had snow and a lot of people, other places did not. So well, I guess the time will tell on that one.
Yeah, certainly. We'll check back in on that, but interesting to hear about. Yeah, well, that's interesting to hear about. And I'm sure many listeners to Gear 30 do have an Icon Pass. So maybe they're listening to this conversation and they're like, you know what? This sounds pretty interesting. I've always wanted to go up and ski in Alaska. And now that Alyeska is on the Icon Pass, this might be their chance. So Eric, maybe just run through like what a good trip to Alaska should look like and maybe some of the planning considerations and other things that people should be thinking about when they come to ski Alyeska for the first time.
Well, now you're throwing me under the bus to all the locals that I'm telling all the Icon Pass holders to come up. I'm just kidding. No, there's a lot of ways to do Alyeska as a, you know, whether you have an Icon Pass or you just want to make a trip up here. There's some good sightseeing around. You can tag it in with some Northern Lights viewing and more central Alaska and make more of a trip out of it. Or you can just come to Girdwood and ski Alyeska. What I see a lot of families doing, and I think it's a pretty rad way to set it up, is, you know, get either a rental house or stay at the Hotel Alyeska or the Alyeska Resort Hotel. You can book a day or two on the cat or heli, or maybe part of your group can, and the other part can go ski the resort. And it's really cool that way, even if you don't end up getting the weather to go heli skiing. If you do and it lines up, it's an incredible experience. If you end up just skiing the resort, it's great too. There's a new Nordic spa, newish Nordic spa at the hotel, that is a really cool experience as well, with a bunch of outdoor, you know, hot tubs and different temperature pools and saunas and whatnot. So, there's plenty to do here besides skiing, you know, from dog mushing to snowmobile tours and all that stuff. But really just kind of locate us. A lot of people I've talked to will rent because it is cheaper to rent a place in Anchorage sometimes, or maybe they don't know the distance, and it's not that big of a distance from Anchorage to Girdwood. But I think staying in Girdwood, it's a whole different experience where you get the ski town vibe. It's a quiet place. There are a lot of Airbnbs as everywhere, and that is getting kind of sorted out in this town. If you do, you know, book a spot, there's a free shuttle, or you can stay right above the shop. We have a couple of rentals called the Powder Inn, or the Hotel Alyeska is also at the base of the tram. So lots of options here, and it's definitely worth a trip. But don't tell anyone around here, I told you.
Yeah, and so there's the insider's report. Thanks, Eric. We'll keep it on the down low. But yeah, I can attest to all of that. Girdwood is such a cool town. Definitely worth like staying in the heart of Girdwood. And you can even stay above Powderhound, as Eric just mentioned, which is like ski in, ski out to Alyeska Resort. So super cool. And I think it's a worthwhile trip for anyone who's interested.
Sweet.
Well, you know, we've had Alpine Bindings on our mind here at Blister quite a bit the last couple of seasons. Many of our listeners know that we have the same ski that's been mounted with effectively every Alpine binding out there. And we've done a lot of testing on pretty much all of these Alpine bindings. It's been like a couple year process at this point. We haven't like published anything conclusively. We've done a lot of flash reviews, which you can read about. And you know, the biggest takeaway is that like a lot of Alpine bindings have been really pretty good, and that there's subtle differences that might make people have a preference one direction or the other. But Eric, I wanted to get some of your perspective on this, just because you're seeing it from a different vantage point as someone who's in a shop day in and day out, and kind of get your like state of the industry on where we're at with bindings. So the first thing I'm just going to ask you is like, since you started Powderhound, what do you think have been like the most positive changes to Alpine bindings? And yeah, we'll just start there.
I would say the first thing that comes to mind would be boot compatibility, where we've kind of gotten over this hill of, oh, this binding works with this boot, or this, you know, this one does not. And you sell a customer a boot, and then they bring in their skis, and you're like, oh no, this boot doesn't work with that binding. So you have to kind of maneuver that and softly break it to them that if they want to ski their new boot, they also have to get a new binding. Gripwalk has been out long enough now that every binding is accepting it for the most part. And so I think that's, that's one thing that has been a nice positive change, that the ski boot manufacturers and bunny manufacturers are all working together to make it easy for us to sell gear and for people to buy them and not have to get pigeonholed into one thing or another.
Yeah. Thank God. That was an uncomfortable couple of years in the industry where it's like, you have to like be like, oh God, is this going to, I'm going to have to also talk about a binding if I sell this boot, and it's going to be this whole thing. And there's just always those issues coming up. And so like, thankfully that has been sort of just, yeah, it's calmed down a bit, which is the right call.
Yeah. One other thing was, the weight of bindings has changed a bit, which I think is a good thing. Sometimes you want a heavier binding. Sometimes a light binding's nice. The old STH2s were pretty bulky bindings. I know people are still asking for them. It's definitely a really nice binding. But seeing the new Strive 16 and what it can do has been, it's been nice. You know, it dropped quite a bit of weight. So, you know, you're not carrying that all around up to the hill and the parking lot and whatnot. But you're still getting that good ski ability. So not just that binding, but all the bindings, you know, like everything, everyone's trying to make it stronger and lighter.
Yeah. And as you've seen bindings go lighter, do you have like any durability concerns or anything that you've been seeing there? Or does it seem like it's been okay so far?
For the most part, okay. I do try sometimes to test out. I'll put something on the lighter side of what I would recommend for someone on my stuff, just so I can test out and say, hey, is this actually strong enough to put someone my size on? And like this year I put a, for the first time, a Strive, but I put a Strive 12 on a ski and been skiing that quite a bit. It skis great, but now I know I should be a 14 or 16 if I'm selling it to someone else. So, you know, I'm 175 pounds and type 3 skier, and 99% of the time it works just fine. And it is nice having that lighter weight. However, there's a couple times where all of a sudden my ski's off my foot, and you know, which sometimes is a good thing, but how fast it came off was kind of an alarming thing. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to stop skiing them, but knowing how to ski them and now knowing what I can sell, who I can sell them to better is a good thing. So,
and like, just for reference, what do you usually ride your Dins at?
Normally 8.5.
Okay.
8.5 or 9.
I got you. And then let's talk about, I guess, like from the reliability side, just because I think shops have this really interesting perspective where they get to like test bindings all the time, as far as like what their actual value, release value is. And that's something that a lot of people never see or even know that that happens in, you know, the back room of a shop. And so I guess, you know, just for someone who's like really new to this conversation, you could talk about like what you're actually measuring as far as like a release value, and then like how reliable you find that value to be, and if this is like something we basically need to be worried about or something that's like, you know, it's pretty impressive these days, this isn't really an issue, our bindings releasing when they're supposed to.
Well, for the most part, we do see them releasing when they're supposed to. However, most of the time, if we're going to, you know, test a customer's binding that had, like, maybe they're worried about it. Of course, they're worried about it for a reason. And so that's when we'll start seeing, oh, okay, there's a little discrepancy. You know, it releases correct at a 9, but they chart at a 7. And then a lot of, you know, thankfully, a lot of times it's on an older binding. So it leads you to, you call the customer, explain it to them. Hey, this is what's going on. We can adjust your din on here, or you can take this as a moment to upgrade your binding. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times they'll bite to upgrade the binding because it's a 8-year-old binding, been skied a lot, and there's no wonder why the springs aren't acting the same way they used to. But for the most part, and rentals and everything like that, they seem to release when they're supposed to, which is good within their realm. I'd say, you know, I don't know if I had to pick a number, maybe 1 out of 10 or 15 skis has to be adjusted. But for the most part, it's pretty great how they're coming and how they hold their, you know, a lot of people crank their din down at the end of the season. I personally don't. I also don't keep my gear for that long. So it's kind of a, if you're trying to get the most out of your gear, probably a wise idea to do so. But yeah, in general, it's awesome how steady the safety of these bindings is.
That's great. Great to hear. And then let's just talk a bit more. You just mentioned people cranking their din down or like basically like giving the spring a break over the spring and summer. I want you to talk about a bit more about that, like as far as springs and maybe like their life, and is this something that people should be doing? It's okay if you don't have a strong opinion on that. But then also the other thing I would be curious to hear you talk about is, how do you advise customers like who are like skiing at a pretty high din? Like, where should they be within a din window on a binding? And is there like a really strong opinion there as far as like you should always be sort of in the middle of the spring?
Well, some of it comes down to, I mean, I can just say, when you're going to invest money, invest it in the safety aspects of something, right? So when it comes to spring tension and where the din is, the higher the din the binding can go, the more expensive it's going to cost. So what happens a lot is that people will say, oh, I only need a shift 10. My din's a 8 or a 9. Like, okay, well, yeah, that will adjust to your din, but is that the right way? And yeah, binding manufacturers always recommend somewhere in the middle of the din range. You know, don't try and save $50 just so you can fit into a cheaper binding with the din range. But yeah, that is something, you know, people will crank their bindings. That does put more stress on the spring. It also doesn't release when it's supposed to. You know, I see a couple people every year tear something they're not supposed to tear because they don't want their skis coming off. And it's a shame when, you know, we set them to something and they come back in at 12 or 13 when we set them at a 9 and they say, yeah, this something's wrong with my binding. Well, nothing wrong with your binding. It held you in when it was supposed to, but it was set a little too high. So, yeah, I would say, you know, a lot of people, I mean, to bring up that, it's people will buy a brand new ski and bring in a grocery bag with some 10-year-old bindings and say, hey, can I use these? And it's like, well, yeah, but I don't put used tires on a new car. I usually just ride them with the new tires. And so you're bringing something that has already served its purpose on another ski and putting it on a new ski to try and get it to live a longer life on that. So, you know, skis, if you want to find a good deal on something, but bindings and boots is where you want to invest your money and not worry about saving a dollar here and there. I know skiing is an expensive sport, so it is important to save sometimes, but yeah, bindings are what keep us safe on the hill.
A new binding is a lot cheaper than a new ACL, that's for sure.
Yes, indeed.
No, that's a good reminder and a good thing for people to think about. Just like, I think bindings are like the not exciting part a lot of times. And so it's just like, oh, let's just put whatever binding on it. And like to some extent, that's probably true. Like most people could probably pick from like 4 great binding options every time they make a new ski. And it probably really is just like small differences that maybe make them go one direction or the other. But when it comes to like really making that investment for the new ski, it's probably a lot better off that you just also upgrade the binding.
Indeed.
Cool. Well, I think, yeah, just the binding reliability and also like thinking about longevity of springs is an interesting thing to talk about. So thanks for some of your thoughts on that. As far as like advancements that you've seen in alpine bindings, you know, where are we at? Like, what are some things that kind of excite you? Where do you think we still have maybe some room to improve? And I mean, if anything, yeah.
Well, maybe a boa binding. I'm just kidding. I'm kidding. I think I like seeing the bindings getting closer. The AFD is getting closer to the ski as far as where the boot sits. In my, you know, I know in race skis, the higher you are, the better leverage you have. And same with any ski. However, I personally really like the feel of a ski when you're lower to it, whether it be an all mountain ski or a powder ski. There is a cool on another note. It's not a binding that sits too close to the ground or, you know, going to place your boot low to the ski, but the Protector Attack from Tyrolia, I think that's a huge advancement in bindings, and can never understand why I don't order more, because no matter how many I order, we're going to sell out. They are, it's a binding that they can actually say in the paperwork with all the little litigation stuff we have in our country, they can actually say this binding is safe for your knees. And the way that it releases, you know, it is a little bit bulkier because they have to fit that new technology in it. I think that's just going to keep getting better and better. This next year, we'll see The tow come off of a demo rail, so that's a good thing. Save a little bit of weight there. But anyways, I think that's a really cool advancement in bindings. And I see the rest of the industry, well, I'm sure they're going to try and kind of catch up and keep up to that. So good job, Tyrolia.
Yeah. And for anyone who's interested in hearing more on that, there is an entire Gear 30 episode that Jonathan did with Tyrolia on the Protector. So all the details are in that episode. And, you know, we're talking about how all Alpine bindings, like new bindings on the market, can be, you know, generally pretty good. There might be certain like user interface aspects that make people have a preference, strong preference of one binding over the other, even just like how it feels when you step in, stuff like that. But the Protector is one that is kind of an outlier in the category currently just because of what they are doing to help sort of address the knee issue. That's cool. Thanks for speaking to that. So then, I mean, we'll talk a bit about Alpine touring bindings as well, but Eric, like, how do you personally think about bindings? And I mean, do you have any preferences? You're like, oh, I just really love the way this heel piece feels when I step in, stuff like that.
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, the first contact with your ski is your boot clicking into your binding. And when you step in and hear that or feel that contact and hear that audible sound of, hey, you're in, let's go skiing. That's a pretty cool thing to have. And whether, you know, it's the more of a thump that you get from a marker binding with that spring shooting up a little further, or a look for that matter, or you get more of a Salomon heel, or Atomic, you know, whatever brand is on it, but where you get more of a click, you still have that reassurance, like, cool, I'm in, you know? And so I think getting to know whatever bindings you prefer, they're all becoming easier to step into. There are some that are easier than others, and that each manufacturer will tell you why that's better than the next one. But, you know, get something that's easy to step into in soft snow. So if you do lose a ski on the North Face or any sort of off trail conditions, you're not struggling to step into it, especially if you're a new skier. But just something that you feel comfortable skiing is a big thing. And so we do see people that it's like Salomon shoes, most people that we sell a Salomon shoe to they're already wearing a pair of the same shoes. They just want another pair because they know they're going to need it. Same happens with certain bindings, whether it's a marker binding and they've always been on a Griffin. Of course, they're going to get another Griffin because they love that feel of what it's like to step in and they like the way it skis. Same with Salomon bindings. People like to go and it has been a thing with the STH going away of like, oh, where do I go from here? And thankfully, the heel of the Strive is very similar. So it's kind of easy for them to see that similarity and say, okay, I'll go with that Strive.
Is there anything like just like notorious, like you're like, this is the most durable binding I've seen in the last 10 years that it's like, this binding's indestructible? Or do you think it's just kind of like depends on the use case?
It depends. Because you could look at like a Pivot 15 or 18 and say, this thing is burly. But then all of a sudden the heel piece rips out of the ski and, yeah, you know, and they're without a ski or something. So you want to match up your skis and your bindings well. That is something a lot of people don't think of. We'll see a lot of the young kids, they'll get a bent 110 or a bent 120 and, oh, I want to throw a Pivot on here. And the ski is great. The binding's great. The small heel hole pattern does not match up with the lightweight core and width of the ski. So you're going to have more of a likelihood of having issues down the road. So we try to acknowledge that when people are trying to pick out bindings and skis together. And, you know, obviously we're going to let them buy whatever they want to buy, but try to influence it as safely as possible so that they're going to have the best experience possible. Yeah. So as far as burliness, it's hard to beat any sort of 15 or 18 den binding, no matter what brand you go with. The more metal there is on the binding, the better as far as that goes. But very few people actually need that.
Yep, totally. And yeah, I think those are some important distinctions from someone like yourself who just sees it day in and day out. You know, it's easy to be like, oh, the look Pivot is such a cool binding, but then it's like, I think that is a bit of a trend that you see from a lot of the teenagers, but mm-hmm. I also see like 10-year-olds skiing like a Pivot and I'm like, I don't think you really need that Pivot on that youth ski, but that's okay.
Exactly.
They feel cool, so that's all right.
Yeah, yeah. Or, you know, or maybe they got a smoking deal and their kid said they want a look binding and all of a sudden they bring the Pivot 14 for a kid ski and you're like, huh, the binding's heavier than the skis.
Cool. Well, thanks for speaking to some of the stuff on the Alpine side. Now let's just kind of merge now with Alpine touring bindings. And I guess my first question for you would be, where is that trend at as far as like people having dedicated AT setup or maybe having more of like the one ski quiver with something like a Duke PT or Salomon Shift? How are you kind of seeing that trend as far as backcountry touring and some compatibility with people's setups? How are you seeing that trend unfold currently in Alaska?
So I think like everywhere, the past 4 years has been, got to get a backcountry setup. So whether it was 50-50 or full touring, we sold a ton, and now we're seeing that decline, and you know, in a big way. So we're selling, and you can never really predict it, but seeing how many backcountry setups we sold in the last few years, you have to know that going forward, it's like, okay, we're going to sell more Alpine because people are realizing maybe that they actually don't like backcountry skiing, or you know, now they've got that. Now it's time to refresh their Alpine setup. So we've seen the boot world, because there's so many good 50-50 options, people are still, they still have the desire with boots to have a walk mode and have the option to go uphill. With bindings, you know, we saw a huge decline in backcountry binding sales this year. And so, you know, they might be buying a walk mode boot, but maybe they already have a backcountry setup, or maybe their buddy sold them one, or they found some on Marketplace or whatever it is. So we saw a big decrease in backcountry binding sales, and that's okay because how busy it was the last few seasons with that, you have to know that it's coming. The Duke PT and the Shift have been, you know, really great. The Shift started, then the Duke PT started, you know, kind of catching up a little bit, and really it's different people we sell them to. The Duke PT is an awesome binding if you're mostly going to be at the resort and maybe you're a little harder on your gear, you want to kick your toe, you know, kick the snow off your toe. The Shift is a little bit lighter, you have to know that it's made of a lot of plastic, but it skis amazing and serves its function really well. So yeah, where that's gone, we've seen take a little bit of that market is cast, and a lot of the kids, because they love their pivots, when they do get into a touring setup, they don't mind spending the extra bit of dough to go with the cast setup. And now the cast 2.0 is going to be even better, I think, next year, and easier to work on, that's for sure. You don't have to swap the toes around and do all that. So that's kind of been a little bit of a market share that they're taking. I don't know how the politics between cast and look work, but I'm sure they're working pretty well together. So
cool. And I mean, how long have you guys been selling cast?
This was our first real season selling. I think we had a little bit in the spring of last year, but this is our first real season selling them. And knowing that there's 120 freeride kids on the mountain many times a week, and they all love the pivot, it seems like. So it's kind of a no-brainer. They're going to want to do something where they can ski a pivot in the backcountry as well.
Cool. Yeah, I think that makes sense. And it'll be interesting to hear like where that continues to go, and sort of like as you've been with cast for a few years, maybe how that trend tracks as well. But I think it definitely makes a lot of sense given what you're saying. And then also next year with some of the improvements to the Shift binding, we'll see, I guess, maybe where the Shift, like if it continues to gain market share once again and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think new colors alone are going to help. Mm-hmm. But having those little things where, you know, people come in and say, oh, what do you think about the Shift? I hear my buddy said this or my buddy said that. And their buddies are never completely wrong because their buddy had something happen to them, right? Whether they're bashing their toe on the toe piece and kick a plastic piece off, it still is going to ski, but you're missing that little center plastic piece. That's because you're kicking plastic in cold temperatures. Or, you know, the fact that the AFD was lowering, you know, all things that shit like Salomon and those other brands that make them have worked in the past few years at making better. They just haven't called it a 2.0. So now you get a little different riser on it, different colors. It'll be a nice refresh to see on the wall.
Yeah, definitely. And I know we've been skiing that binding quite a bit this spring, and we'll continue to and report any thoughts that we have on some of the changes they made. Nice. Well, then I guess as far as Alpine touring bindings go, what have you seen as far as like your thoughts on like the most durable bindings or some bindings that kind of deserve some recognition in that space?
I think a really underrated binding for touring is the Atomic or Solomon, the Backland by Atomic or the Solomon MTN. Simplistic, durable. I haven't seen a single warranty claim or anything like that come through the shop. We always tend to sell out of them. And they're light. They're just simple to use. You can use it with or without a brake. I don't know. That being said, they did do a recall, which I thought was, you know, they got to do it, which is great. They went ahead and did it ahead of time instead of waiting until more negative stuff may have happened to it. But even that being said, like, we took care of a couple of those, but it wasn't, I've never seen anything negative from those bindings in the shop. And everybody we sell them to loves them. So the only downside is not having a release value per se, you know, where you can adjust it from number to number, you know, on a whole different tech binding level. I think the rotation is the next burliest one that I've seen. That's where I should say with the least returns of broken parts. You know, the only part that we see frequently, or not frequently, but if anything, it would be the brake on those, the little slider on the brake, the spring might, you know, bust or something, and you just replace the brake mechanism. So overall, I think that for more of a safer TUV certified, safer for your knee touring binding, tech binding, DynaFit rotation. Yeah, I've been skiing the 14. I love it. It's a little extra weight on the way up. So you don't get that, you know, that super lightness like you can get out of other bindings, but knowing that when you step into it, it does have a little bit of a safer, you know, mechanisms to it. So definitely worth paying a little extra for as far as like carrying weight goes to be a little safer on the descent.
And then to follow up on that, have you skied the new ridge binding, or do you have any like thoughts on that, or sort of some excitement?
No, I have not skied it. I've seen it. I have not skied it. I am excited to maybe test it out next year, but have you?
I haven't. Paul Forward is the one who's skiing it.
Yeah, I know. We got the same boot sole. I should borrow a pair this spring and go skiing. I know. I think he could go without a ski for a day. He might have extras. but you know, it looks really cool. The fact that you don't have to twist the heel around, and the step-in's easier from what they say, and it looks like it would be. I'm excited about it.
Yeah, definitely intriguing, and hopefully we all get some more time on that here soon.
Yeah.
Cool, Eric. Well, I think you are, you know, really helping provide an interesting perspective on Alpine bindings, Alpine touring bindings. You know, being in a shop, seeing these things day in and day out, seeing every possible combination of skis, boots, bindings, and helping people find the best solution for them every single day, I think definitely gives you some really helpful insight. And, you know, then there comes the time where it's just your turn to ski, and you don't want to, you know, have to think about all these things. So what do your personal preferences look like, if you have any, when it comes to both Alpine and Alpine touring bindings?
You know, it's tough. My preference changes. I try to ski a little bit of everything, because then I can sell them a lot better. If I'm always on one, you know, we have guys on our crew that are just huge pivot fans, and guess what? All they sell is pivots. Well, we don't need to carry other brands if we're only selling one, right? So we need to have people that can attest to, hey, this is how this skis, this is what, you know, makes a difference, or this is how this steps in. And then you can listen to the customers and see what you think they might want if they don't have a preference. Anyways, that being said, I do like the way the Strive skis. I like the way the Shift skied when I had a pair. I don't currently. I've got a Marker Jester, and that's like tried and true. Of course, it's a great binding. I have a Tyrolia Attack 14 on the Unleashed 108s. Love how low it is to the ski. Love how it steps in. Never had any issues with it. And then I have a Look SPX on a skinnier M Pro 90, and I really love just the simplicity of pretty much all these bindings. You don't have to worry about it. You just step in, they're going to be good to go. Just pick the din, or listen to your salesperson, whoever you're talking to in a ski shop, hopefully is where you're buying these bindings, and talk to them because they know. Likely they've skied a bunch of different bindings and they can tell you the pros and cons. I think when it comes down to it, like you said earlier in the conversation, like people don't know a whole lot about bindings. Honestly, when you said, hey, let's talk about bindings, I said, well, okay, let's make the least exciting part of a sale into a podcast, because people really, they're just like, I don't care. Just put a binding on it. Well, it does matter. And it does matter how the person's skiing. And so it's cool that you got me to take a little bit deeper thinking into it. And it does make a difference on this ski, not only color, which all these companies are coming out with really cool color matchups and stuff. But how you're going to be able to, you know, lay your skis on the ground, click in and go start your fun. So, and as far as backcountry bindings go, like I said, I'm on a Dynafit Rotation 14 and I've got it on a La Machine. It's been a really fun ski this season. And then my previous skis, I had a G3Z on, and I've heard people hate on the Zed, but I always had good experience with it, especially for the weight that it carried. So it's a super lightweight binding for how powerful it felt. So anyways, lots of good options out there.
Well, and I know personally there's been times where I felt like a lot more particular about my bindings, but as I've skied more bindings, I think I've gotten less particular. To me, it's really just about the safety aspect, which I think we've touched on here. Like, is the binding going to work for what I need it to do in this particular application? And that's definitely not the part to overlook. You know, just keep in mind that like at the end of that sale, your salesperson, they've talked boots maybe with you, they've talked skis, and now they're going to talk bindings. It's maybe not the most fun part, but it definitely warrants some consideration and attention. And, you know, you might not be like having a make or break experience between two brands, but just giving some thought to why the binding is important and, you know, what it is doing for you out on the hill. And, you know, the safety aspect is can't be overstated.
Yeah, what do you have on your skis?
Oh, well, I don't really have personal skis. So
about on the skis when you were up here?
Oh, I had the Strive, but it's a demo Strive on the ARW. And then I had the Griffin on the Mindbender 116. And
what do you think about the demo Strive?
It's been like mostly fine. I like felt initially that the demo Strive just felt like a little different, especially in the toe piece. So I just kind of had to get used to that. But I like the way it skis now that I've gotten used to it and haven't had any issues personally. So yeah, it's worked for me. And I mean, that's the one thing is all the reviewers here at Blister get really used to skiing demo bindings because that gives us a lot of flexibility. And then I go to ski like an Alpine binding, and that's also been interesting is like comparing demo versions of a binding to their regular Alpine counterpart. And you know, sometimes there are subtle differences, but again, it's not like we're like completely changing the experience on a ski because we're on a demo version of a particular binding.
Yeah, it is funny how a lot of people think that demo bindings are just junk. And you're like, well, that's most of the time what I ski. You know, if I'm if I'm grabbing something for a break from the shop or whatever, it's like we all ski on demos all the time. Mm-hmm. And the new demo bindings are great. So there was some rough ones in the past, but those are behind us.
Yeah, I only have one instance of completely blowing up on a demo binding and having it break. And I was going really fast on like the fastest groomer at Mount Crested Butte. So I was like, you know, that was one of those moments where I was a little too close for comfort. But like knowing how fast I was going and like the outcome was actually pretty good given the circumstance, I'm not really necessarily going to blame the binding for that one.
High speed groomer crash. Yeah, those are fun. Nice.
Cool. Any last words, Eric, on bindings or anything else?
No, I think we covered a lot on there. I appreciate you having me on. It was, I don't know, got to think a little bit more about what I don't normally think about, which is the kind of the shortest part of a sale is like, which binding do I go with? So, thanks for that. And looking forward to seeing some new stuff come out next year, and seeing what you guys think about them too beforehand.
Cool. Yeah, well, thanks for talking bindings with me and all things, you know, skiing Alaska and helping guide people to what that might look like if they plan a trip. And what's next for you guys? I mean, when do you think you're going to be actually riding bikes, or is it still skiing for weeks to come?
You know, my 4-year-old was out pedaling around on the road, finally thawed out. So he was out. He couldn't wait to get his bike out. So I had him out this week. people are starting to pedal around, but no, we had a long time before trails are thawed out. So that's the long mud season up here. But the bike park did announce that they are opening this year. There was a lot of doubt and talk that they weren't going to, but they will be opening. So that is very exciting for us as a shop at the base of the mountain. So we'll be doing, you know, our normal operations again, which is exciting. So we'll probably be starting to pedal trails late May or early June. So we've got a little while, but thankfully there's lots of ski touring to be done after the resort closes here in a couple weeks.
Awesome. Well, thanks, Eric. Enjoy the transition into spring and make the most of the turns while they're there. Thanks for joining me on Gear 30 today.
Thank you, Kara. Always great to be on the show and catch up with you.
Yeah, we'll talk to you soon. All right, everyone. Well, there you have it. Another episode of Gear 30. Thanks so much to Eric for the fun conversation. It was great to catch up with you. Thanks to our multi-talented podcast producer, Justin Bob. Thanks, of course, to you all for tuning in as well, week in and week out. We sure do appreciate our Blister audience. And we will talk to you again real soon. Thanks, everybody. Cheers.